Thank you for having me. So ideas of individuality and differences in perception are very ancient questions. And for most of human history, this was explained by metaphysical differences and differences of souls. But starting with the scientific revolution, people tried to find physical explanations for differences in how we perceive the world. René Descartes recognized that there were physical rules to how we perceived the world, there were physical rules to how we sensed the outside world, and physical rules with regard to how these physical senses translated to physical motion. He got a lot of specifics wrong here, but the general idea was correct, that our bodies were an input-output device where you sense the world, such as a flame, which then led to... So retraction of the limb. But even he recognized that our behaviors weren't simply reflexive, that wasn't simply just an input-output relationship of environment to behavior, that there was some variability there. To explain that variability, he also sought a metaphysical explanation where we all shared similar sensory apparatuses, such as the eyes, and similar output apparatuses, such as muscle. And to explain the differences in how we react to the world, he explained it through a filtering through the pineal gland, which he thought was the source of the soul. So according to Descartes, yes, our behavior is based on physical principles, but variability and individuality was a result of differences in souls. Now, of course, neuroscience isn't based on that. It's based on the idea that it's all physical, and it's all based upon this elegant structure here, the brain, or mostly based on the brain. It's an elegant structure because it's not simply just a random assortment of neurons. There are a variety of regions of the brain that are specialized for certain input-output relationships. And it's surprising that these input-output relationships are fairly robust, that certain parts of the brain are robust to inputs, despite the fact that the units of computation, the neuron, has to deal with the inherent stochastic properties of chemistry, all the way from sensing to the neuron itself, to the communication between neurons, all the way out to communication to the muscle. And despite all these different sources of stochastic chemistry in the process, due to a variety of mechanisms such as simply spike averaging, we produce very ordered outputs. What that means is that organisms that share the same brain basically have the same behavior. So as an example, we have an example here where we have an input, which is this guy playing a trombone, and a variety of organisms that share the same brain, these cattle, are all responding to it. And on average, the population responds in the same fashion. They're all attracted to this trombone. But individually, there's a lot of variability here. They're all attracted, but some are going faster, some are wandering off, some are pausing. But on average, they're attracted. So you can say there's a shared behavior because they all have the same brain. And they have the same environment, neural history. But there's some variability here. And when dealing with a computer, you think, well, variability is a bad thing. You don't want the computer to do something differently every time you press the letter K. In biology, variability is a good thing because it provides a substrate for learning and for exploring your environment. And so, these cattle that are wandering off here, perhaps they're not responding to the trombone, but perhaps they notice, there's some hay or something, which is a better stimulus. So a classic paradigm to address these issues of learning and variability is the songbird, the zebrafinch. So this particular species of zebrafinch isn't born with the innate adult song. And the innate adult song is important for mating. But they are born with the ability to generate songs. So when they're born, they generate these songs that have defined structure. But every time they play a different song, every time they try to play a song, they produce different songs of structure. So there's a lot of variability early on. But then through training, through feedback from listening to adults, this variability slowly decreases as the song coalesces around the adult song. Now, this is a very well-studied system. And the basic structure outlined here is that you have these neurons, the HVC neurons, which encode the timing of the song. And they project to these motor neurons, which engage the muscles which produce the song. And, there it is. It's recent work from Ben Tielbetsky's lab. They showed that there's a nucleus here, the LMAN structure, which projects onto these muscles and injects variability into the song structure. And so if you remove this variability, the novice songbird can still produce these sub-songs, but it gets stuck. It no longer learns to produce the adult song. It just keeps producing whichever song was produced here. And if you remove the structure after it's learned the adult song, then everything's fine. So this structure is important for learning because it injects variability into the song structure. So they can sample different aspects of song space and arrive at the correct one. They also continued this work with human psychophysics. So there's a similar experiment where you have a human which has to move this arm along a specific trajectory. And so the humans do these trials for a while. And then afterward, a force is applied to this arm, which makes it difficult to follow the correct trajectory. And then they have to learn to move the arm correctly. What they found is that individuals who had a high level of variability in their behavior at baseline, so one standard deviation above baseline, these individuals were faster at learning than individuals who had lower variability in baseline. These individuals were slower at learning. You can see that here. Lower variability individuals had a slower learning rate than high variability individuals.
Yeah, so that's actually a bit similar to what you said about birdsong.
Yes.
So if you remove the basal ganglia source of variability, even when the song is fully developed, it's you're not really okay because the song is too stable. And now if you have to adapt to the changes in you still need some variability for that.
Right. It also looks as aging because as they age, you have to adapt to the differences in your muscles, and those birds are not good at doing that.
They're not actually capable of doing that.
Right.
And if you it doesn't matter how old the bird is, if you keep changing the training song, the model, and rewarding it or punishing for certain structure, it cannot respond to those.
Yes.
So you need intrinsic variability, no matter.
Yes.
It's not really the same.
Right. And variability is useful throughout. So in fact, professionals, athletes, their motions, like a batter has a very consistent motion to their swing. However, when they're waiting for the ball to be pitched, they have a lot of variability. And amateurs often try to phenocopy that variability. But if you notice that with an amateur, once the ball is pitched, that variability stops because they're trying to anticipate the ball. A professional athlete is better at responding to a fast pitch because they sample motor space. They're constantly sampling motor space and are more quickly to adapt to a 90-mile-an-hour fastball. Okay, so these are all great examples. The difficulty is that with humans and zebrafinches, they have a lot of neurons. Even a zebrafinch has about like a billion neurons, which is way more than the organism I research, which is the C. elegans nematode. So questions I would like to ask are, one, what are the sources of noise? Two, how can this variability be modified? And three, how is this variability generated in the first place in the nervous system? So as I mentioned, I use C. elegans, the nematode here, and here's an example of worms exploring their environment. Look, that movie doesn't want to play. Okay, well, the worms explore their environment. They do a lot of random walks around here, and they eventually coalesce around an odor source. And the method of finding the odor source relies upon something called a biased random walk, because the challenge is that the odor gradient across this two-dimensional surface here is very, very shallow. They have difficulty assessing the changes in concentration while they're traveling. So the method of finding the odor source is to just randomly orient in space, but then if the environment is good, you lengthen the length of your runs. And so it's a biased random walk, because you're doing this random walk, but you bias length of your runs as the environment improves, and that results in them chemotaxing over to this source. So a question we can ask is, this variability is needed to explore their environment, but how is it generated in the first place, and how is it modified to produce this biased random walk? The advantage of the worm is that we have explicit knowledge of this perception apparatus, the brain of the worm, which is exactly 302 neurons for every single worm. So they have a very deterministic development. They're hermaphrodites, so makes the genetics much easier. And we have several neuron-specific markers or specific markers for groups of neurons, which allows us to specifically express a variety of molecular tools in specific neurons to perturb the network consistently across individuals. So we have a good hold on the center part of this paradigm. Also, since these worms are so simple, it's very straightforward to automatically and consistently quantify their behavior. So here's an example here, where we have several worms crawling on a two-dimensional auger surface. And you can see that their behaviors are fairly stereotyped. They produce these undulatory motions which propel them forward and backwards. And you can reduce this motion into a variety of easily defined behaviors. They're either moving forward, pausing, or performing aversive behaviors, such as reversals, and something called the megatrend, where they do a deep body bend. So our ability to quantify their behavior is very robust. So now we have a system where we have a good a control over the perception, a good consistent definition of behavior, and we have very good ways of defining their environment. So one challenge of the previous chemotaxis assay I mentioned is that it's difficult to assess what the concentration of odor is across this gradient. And so what the worm is experiencing at each point in space and time is difficult to assess with this type of assay. So to get around that, we use microfluidics. So as I mentioned before, this worm is only about a millimeter long. So we can put them in these arenas with these posts, which allow them to move around, and then provide streams of fluid while they're migrating. Now, since they're so small, the Reynolds number in this environment is quite low. So you have laminar flow when you deliver fluids here. So you get very little mixing. So this allows us to have very good temporal and spatial control over fluid flow over the worm. So we can provide odors in a temporally and spatially precise manner. So now we have an assay where we control the environment precisely, and we can define behavior precisely. So here's an example of this sort of assay, where we have the worms crawling around. Their tracks are colored according to which behavior they're performing. So they're doing forward runs, occasionally they're doing these aversive runs. And while they're in here, odor is being delivered or removed. So right now, they're running track of the ethogram of their behavior. And you add odor, they're pretty happy, they're doing forward runs, you remove odor, they're very upset, they do reorientations. And this phenocopy is what they do for the bias random walk. If the environment is good, you keep going forward. If the environment's getting worse, reorient, try to find out where the odor went. And if you probably notice, the worms are, you know, on average doing the same behavior, but not individually. And if we look at a plot here of their behavior, so on the top plot here are the odor pulses of isoamyl alcohol. Each row here is a different animal, and it's colored according to which behavior they're performing. And this is the population average. And you see the population average is fairly robust. Every time odor is present, they're fairly happy. And then every time you remove odor and you just have buffer, they're fairly upset and perform these aversive stimuli. So the general behavior is fairly predictable. Yes?
But they're not sensing the absolute value of the odor. They're sensing derivatives, right? They have a certain window to integrate.
Right. It depends on the neuron. So this neuron in particular tends to be fairly graded in its response to odor stimuli. But it has habituation to compensate for jumps. We can talk about this later. But
sure.
We actually have a separate paper about this that can talk about that exact issue.
Sorry, one technical question. So the role of these posts was, it seemed like the motion was a little bit more persistent. They were turning a little less.
Yeah, so the purpose of the posts is to have a substrate for them to move on. So if you didn't have the posts, they would just thrash around. They need something to leverage off of while they perform this motion. So if we just had the arenas, they would just lie around. And so actually Dirk spent a long time trying to space them just right so that their motion was as close as possible to the motion on a two-dimensional auger surface. There's a lot of noise here, right? And it's across individuals and within individuals. So if we just bend this according to animals here and stimulus pulse here, on average, the worms get upset when odor is removed. But in each individual trial, there's a lot of noise. And so the beauty with the worm is that we can go back to this worm wiring diagram, which we can represent as a variety of nodes and edges, and ask where does this worm really come from? This is the entire neural network of the worm. So everything the worm could possibly think is encoded in this network. And here's the y-axis here, it's ordered according to presynaptic and postsynaptic neurons. So neurons which are primarily presynaptic are up here, neurons that are primarily postsynaptic are down here. And you can see there's a general structure here, right? The sensory neurons in red are primarily presynaptic, interneurons are in the middle, and then motor neurons are generally postsynaptic. So there's a general degree of structure here that information is flowing down to these motor neurons. And so now we can ask, well, how does information from a specific sensory neuron get transferred through this network down to a command motor neuron, which then engages this motor machinery? And which step along this process is variability generated? So with the specific odor I was talking about, isothiamyl alcohol, it's sensed by the sensory neuron AWC, which projects directly to this command neuron AVA, which engages the reversal machinery of the worm. The topology of this connection matches the behavior of the worm and the neurons. So when odor is present, this neuron is hyperpolarized, that correlates with a lower frequency of reversals in the worm. And when odor is removed, that that causes the depolarization of AWC, which correlates with an increase in reversals. And so one possibility is that the noise, the variability in the system is coming from AWC, which may not be consistently sensing the environment, or AVA, which may not be consistently engaging the motor machinery. So to address that question, we combine this microarray arena and behavioral analysis with fluorescence imaging of the worm by expressing a GCAMP, which is a fluorescence sensor of calcium, specifically in neurons. So we could monitor the fluorescence change, which is a measure of calcium flux in the neuron, therefore activity, and measure how does that calcium change odor input and behavior. So in this example here, here's the worm. It has some autofluorescence in the body, and that little tiny dot there, that's the AWC neuron. That's a single neuron that's been labeled with GCAMP. So we can monitor. What? Why are certain videos working and not others? Okay, well, I did a practice talk and it worked in that setup, but apparently not this one. Okay, so, well, anyway, what you would be able to see is that the worm's crawling around. When odor pulse comes, the neuron is activated, and that correlates with the worm reorienting. So the question we can ask is, is there a disconnect between the sensory neuron and behavior? And the answer is no. So the AWC sensory neuron responds to odor the same way, regardless of what the behavior is doing. So this is a faithful measure of the environment. We can reperform that same experiment with AVA. We find that every time the worm performs a reversal, AVA activity goes up. And every time that reversal is terminated, AVA activity goes down. So both of these are fairly robust neurons, which means the variability is coming from somewhere in between. What I haven't mentioned is that AVA is the most postsynaptic neuron, or one of the biggest hubs in the worm's neural network. So it receives a lot of synapses. So this synapse from AWC probably isn't sufficient to drive it. However, AWC does project to several interneurons. So the question is, are these interneurons the source of the variability in the system?
I'm sure this isn't going to be your answer, otherwise you would set it up differently. But I mean, in principle, it could have been possible that the variability is in the muscle.
Actually, no, because this projects directly to these motor neurons. And every time this is on, the worm performs a reversal. But in a similar line, it could be that the synapse itself here is not consistent. However, there's another student in the lab who's looked into this, and that's not the case. So this is a consistent synaptic release as well. So to look at multiple interneurons at the same time, I use a slightly different assay where I trap the worm so I can do higher resolution imaging of GCAMP fluorescence. And this assay as well, it's laminar flow, so I can provide temporal precise pulses of odor to the nose. And so in this assay, once again, this is a heat map here of calcium activity. Each row here is a different animal, this is time, there's a pulse of odor here in this middle minute. And on average, the AWC neurons consistently hyperpolarize in odor and then depolarize. And within each individual, you also see the same property. Every time you give the AWC neuron an odor pulse, it responds. So we can perform this again with AVA, and we find something similar as we saw before. On average, the AVA neuron decreases the presence of odor, which would lead to lower frequency of reversals, and then it goes back up again when odor is removed. However, individually, there's a lot of variability here. There's a lot of variability before the odor is provided, a lot of variability when the odor is added. And what's shifting here isn't necessarily, there isn't a robust response, but it was shifting the probability of being on rather than this clear response that you see in AWC. And so the beauty of the worm is that we can see this this variability here in AVA. So we can go to the worm diagram and ask, okay, well, which other neurons could possibly be projecting to AVA to provide this variability? So after looking at the network, AWC, its primary targets is AIB, which was previously known to be an important sensory interneuron for behaviors that were produced by AWC activity. So I decided to image AIB and AVA simultaneously to see how their variability correlated. I also included RAM because it was such a heavy a partner to AIB and AVA, both presynaptic and postsynaptically. So it was thought that this might be important as well. So at the time when I did this, most studies with worms just imaged neurons individually, but I decided to image all three of these at the same time since I had neuron-specific markers to label them. So this is AVA, AIB, and RAM. And well, you would just see them turning on and off, and it would match this trace here. Okay, so.
To restart the presentation menu?
Well, I don't want to.
Not the computer.
It's just you know. Yeah. So, if you just look at spontaneous activity in the absence of odor, important features come out here. So it's colored here. This is activity over 3 minutes, and two things immediately pop out. One is that these neurons are highly variable. They're just constantly turning on and off at these different timescales. And two, they're highly correlated. So they tend to turn on and off together. Causative experiments where we express channel rhodopsin in these neurons individually. Channel rhodopsin is an optically activated ion channel, so you can turn neurons on with light. And so if you express channel rhodopsin in AVA, the animals produce reversals. And it's also true for RAM, AIB, and even AWC. In every case, it produces reversals with the worm. So all of these neurons produce reversals, so it's probably not surprising that their spontaneous activity is also correlated. But what you might have also noticed is that there are moments here when AIB is kind of doing its own thing, and it's not correlated with the other two. And in fact, there are several epochs where sometimes only AIB is on. And so we have a few properties here. One, these neurons, their activity can cause reversals. Two, the AWC neuron has a reliable and consistent response to odor. Three, AVA does not have that robust response to odor. And four, when we look at these neurons simultaneously, they seem to fall into three sort of stable network states. They're either all on, all off, or only AIB is on. So now we can ask, well, how does odor change any of these properties? So if we just look at situations where all three neurons were on, we find that they have a highly variable response to odor, which makes sense because AVA had a variable response to odor, and they correlate with AVA. So sometimes, and this is ordered according to the response to odor onset. And so sometimes you can see that you have a robust response to odor onset. So there's a time-locked response here. And it also produces a higher probability of being off when odor is present. But then you have other situations where it just seems to be ignoring the presence of odor. If I just take the situations where only AIB is active prior to odor addition, I see something else. If only AIB is on, then what I see is a robust response to odor onset. So as I mentioned before, this was known to be an important sensory intranet. So in the absence of this motor activity here, even though there's an ongoing variable activity in AIB, it can reliably respond to this odor. So in the sense, it is a sensory interneuron, and it can respond reliably to the odor, so long as these two other neurons are spontaneously off. So with these three neurons, there are three possible network states in principle. And spontaneously, I only observed these three states here. And this provided some information as to what's going on in the network. So what I wanted to know was, what would these other states inform me about how the network is filtering this information. So to generate these states, because I saw them hardly ever or never, I decided to generate these states artificially. I generated them artificially using this tool developed in the lab by Nivin Pokhala, the histamine-gated chloride channel from Drosophila. So the worms don't produce histamine. They don't have any genes that seem to sense it. And behaviorally, they completely ignore it. So it was a nice orthogonal tool to manipulate the neurons, and perform fluorescent GCAMP imaging as well. So here's an example here where I'm expressing GCAMP on the three neurons, but I'm only expressing the histamine-gated chloride channel on RAM and AVA. In the absence of histamine, the neurons are just doing their thing. And then after I add histamine, these neurons are hyperpolarized, but AIB continues to have this activity. So this phenocopies the previous spontaneously observed state I saw earlier. So now I can recreate all these states using this tool and turn out the most informative states were these three here. So this is the wild type state where you occasionally have a robust response to odor onset and a high probability of being off. If I move AIB, which was previously known to be an important sensory interneuron, it recapitulates what we know. So now if you move AIB, you no longer see this nice response to odor, and there isn't a high probability of being off. This is the same result I would observe if I just provided buffer. there's a spontaneous, you know, probability of turning off at this time point, but it's not time locked to the odor. So AIB is important for for transferring information from AWC to the rest of the network. If I phenocopy the spontaneously observed state I saw earlier, I once again see the same phenotype here. In the absence of these two neurons, AIB has a very consistent response to odor addition. However, if I only hyperpolarize RIM, I can still recapitulate this result here. So this was sufficient for AIB to have a robust response to odor. But now what you might also notice is that now AVA also has a better response to odor, because now in RIM's absence, it's more receptive to input from AIB. Now this result was achieved by hyperpolarizing RIM. There's a different tool I could use, tetanus toxin, which abolishes synaptic vesicle reliefs in the neuron. And so if I express that in RIM, I can once again produce the same result here, showing that the chemical synapses here are important for competing with the sensory response. So AIB responds well here, AVA responds well, but now also RIM is also responding well to the odor input, because now RIM is doing less talking and more listening to the gap junctions. So RIM has the ability to influence the network, but it also has the ability to be influenced by the network. So all these experiments were done with a worm trapped in a chip. And we know that the AAV activity is the primary source of driving reversal behavior. So this predicts that if I silence RIM, I should also get a better behavioral response to odor inputs into the worm. So to address that, I can go back to this microarena assay, and I can express GCAMP individually in these neurons and ask how these neurons respond to odor. And as we saw earlier, AWC responds really well to odor. The responses of AIB, RIM, and AVA are quite noisy in response to odor, as they were in the chip. Now, these activities are aligned to odor pulses. If I align their activities to their behavior in the absence of odor, I find that for AIB, RIM, and AVA, the responses are more robust, which is what we would have predicted. When these neurons are activated, they activate reversals. So conversely, when their activity, when spontaneous activity is observed, this is a transfer from forward to reversal. AIB goes up, RIM, AVA. So that makes sense. And when reversals are terminated to the forward runs, they decrease. In contrast, AWC, which is a sensory neuron, it does not have any knowledge of what's going on down at the behavior. So these neurons are both, so they're primarily motor neurons. Well, these are pretty primarily motor neurons, but AIB seems to be in this middle ground of being a sensory neuron and receptive to motor input. So now we can reperform this assay and look at the behavior of the worm during this odor pulse. And this, so we're choosing animals here which are displaying aversive behavior during the pulse. When you provide buffer, there's a spontaneous probability that this aversive behavior will terminate. And that's true for both the wild type and RIM silence background. But now if you... Now if you give odor pulses, you can see this black trace here, the wild type animals, the aversive behavior is more likely to terminate in the presence of odor, which matches the imaging experiments. But you see here in green that if you silence RIM, this behavioral response is more robust, which is what we would have predicted from the neuronal imaging. So it shows that behaviorally, this RIM neuron is influencing this network and injecting some sort of variability or noise into the system, and then in its absence, this input-output transfer is more streamlined. So in summary, what we have here is a robust sensory neuron that's sensing the environment. It's projecting to this neuronal circuit, and the circuit is producing this probabilistic output, which is sometimes predictable and sometimes not. If we perturb the network, remove RIM from the network, now this network is very reliable. If we remove AIB, it's very unreliable. And what we observe here in the wild-type state is a mixture of these two states. So spontaneously, somewhere in the worm, it's fluctuating between the dominance of these neurons. This property of these neurons competing for output for behavior is also seen, well, I guess I also have the summary here. So yeah, so essentially the motor programs are reliable. Motor program is distributed across these interneurons, is highly variable. Sensory information is filtered. But how the sensory information is filtered depends upon the state of this network. This network is also implicated in learning. So the worms have this basic capability to learn. So if you grow them on E. coli and you expose them to Pseudomonas, this bacteria, they're initially attracted to it. They find it very attractive. They'll go and eat it. However, they quickly realize, or after 4 to 6 hours, they quickly realize that this bacteria is bad for them. So this bacteria actually eats them from the inside out. So after exposure to this, if you expose them to the smell of this bacteria again, they are no longer attracted to it. They try to avoid it. So they've associated getting sick with the smell of this bacteria. And some work from Yun Zhang's lab, she went through and she did ablation experiments where she ablated a variety of neurons and asked how these neurons influenced learning. And what she found was that AWC and AIB, these two neurons here, were important for the default preference for the bacteria. If they didn't have these neurons, they didn't have this default preference to go toward it. However, RIM was necessary for learning. So if you removed RIM, they would have this default preference for the bacteria, but they would never learn to avoid it. They never had this neuron to override this system and change their behavior. So the sort of tug and pull between interneurons for influence over behavior is seen in other paradigms as well. And the central learning paradigm is kind of analogous to what I mentioned earlier, where you have a system here, like in the L-man, or in this case RIM, which is competing for that motor output and influencing how robust it is motor output is a function of this input here, in this case odor, in this case these HPC neurons. So I posed these three questions earlier, of the sources of noise, how is it modified, and how is it generated? And I addressed these two for a specific assay. What I'm really interested in understanding is how is normal variability generated in the first place? So these dynamics I saw in these three neurons are actually distributed across several neurons in the worm's brain. So in a recent paper from Manuel Zimmer's lab, which was recently just published a few weeks ago, they expressed GCAMP in all the neurons in the ganglia of the head, and then image the majority of them. And so what you have here, so this is a heat map of spontaneous activity of these neurons over a couple hours, or no, 30 minutes. Anyway, and you see this spontaneous activity that I observed with these three neurons. You have ABA here, RAM is here, and AIB is here. So they're all fluctuating together, as I saw earlier, with this whole population of neurons. So there's a whole group of neurons in the worm's brain that appear to have this internally generated neuronal dynamics. What I haven't mentioned before is that when I first started looking into this, I tried all these different sensory means. And it didn't matter how much of the world I tried to remove from the worm sensory system. They still had this internally generated variability. I think that's interesting because it provides a substrate for learning and a substrate for producing variability to search their environment. So a challenge is to understand how is this generated in the first place? Because it's very distributed. As I showed before, even when I hyperpolarized any of these neurons, it changed the response to the environment, but it didn't get rid of this spontaneously generated state. My future aims are, one, to develop methods to isolate and perturb some of the networks of neurons to understand how the state is generated, and then two, understand how these states are generated in different timescales. Because what I've been talking about is the timescale of crawling, but they actually have a lot of spontaneous activity with regard to head motion, which is on a different timescale, and a decision, which is made on a longer timescale, which is this Dow decision, which I'll discuss in a second. Okay. So there are a lot of tools that can be used for manipulating and monitoring neuronal activity. We have tools to optically excite neurons, tools to chemically inhibit them, calcium sensors, which are spectrally separated. So we have a green sensor and red sensors, which allow for simultaneous imaging at different wavelengths. And we also have an electro detector. So this is a glutamate sensor, which is similar to GCAMP. The fluorescence of the sensor changes upon binding glutamate. So as an example, some previous work I did, I expressed this glutamate sensor in AVA. So AVA is not glutamatergic. However, RAM, AIB, AWC, and AIZ are glutamatergic. And AVA is a target of these neurons. So AVA expresses AMPA and NMDA-like glutamate receptors. So by expressing this glutamate sensor in AVA, I could monitor neurotransmitter input into this neuron. And while I did that, I also expressed RCAMP in this neuron, so they're spectrally separated here. So here's the glue snuffer, here's the cell body. You can hardly see the process here. And it can monitor both of them simultaneously. And as you would predict, the input into the system, the green line here of glutamate, predicts the response of the neuron in red. And I should probably provide a zoom in here, but it's correlated by, so this rise in glutamate signal actually precedes red signal by about a second or a fraction of a second. So you see the input coming in, and then the neuron responding. And so now we can do this in combination for a variety of different neurons to try to understand input-output relationships with regard to glutamate. Something else I mentioned, so you know, these three neurons I looked at are part of a larger network of neurons that have these sort of fluctuating global states. And what I didn't mention is that this paneuronal experiment that was done looking at all these different neurons, they looked at a lot of neurons, but there were a lot of neurons they were, for technical reasons, were not capable of observing, especially AIY, AIA, and AIZ, which are neurons which are known to be important for behavior. The challenge with these neurons and the reason why they weren't imaged is because that imaging was done with the calcium sensor expressed in the nucleus of the cell. And these neurons in particular don't seem to show very much calcium dynamics in the soma, but they show a lot of calcium dynamics in the process. But all these processes are sort of bundled together. So here's a diagram here of, say, AIB and AIA. So if you have GCAMP of both of these neurons, it's really difficult to measure the fluorescence of this process in the presence of AIB dynamics. But if you spectrally separate the neurons, express RCAMP and AIB, and GCAMP and AIA, now you can image AIA or AIY simultaneously with other neurons by doing a spectral separation. And these other neurons also contribute to this motor program, but in different ways. So AIA is often anti-correlated with AIB, but then has all this other activity, the rules for which I have no idea what they are. The same with AIB and RIB. AIB is tuned into the reversal program, RIB is tuned into the forward program, so as you'd predict, they're anti-correlated. And AIY sometimes correlates with the forward program, and it sometimes has this other activity here. And so these other neurons probably are contributing to this global state, but we're blind to it in that other assay. But combining these tools, we can now look at what the rules are with regard to how these neurons behave in the presence of these global dynamics. And that's important because naively we might think that we have these global dynamics that are all correlated, so that means if you turn on one neuron, you could turn on another neuron if they tend to be correlated. As an example here, I express crimson, a redshifted channel rhodopsin, and AVA. Since it's redshifted, I could also monitor the fluorescence of RM in AAB while I stimulated AVA. And we can see here is that there's a fairly good relationship between AVA, or fairly robust relationship between AVA turning on during the red pulse, and AIB and AIB and RIM also responding. So the relationship between stimulating AVA to RIM is fairly linear here. They have basically the same response. So we can use this approach to start to try to understand the transfer functions between neurons and build up a network of interactions. But the problem and the catch is that, you know, we think of this network as, you know, this feed-forward network that's transmitting information down, and yet information can also robustly go up. But now if I put crimson and AIB and stimulate it on different timescales, it consistently turns AIB on, but inconsistently turns the other neurons on. And we know from channel rhodopsin experiments that on average it can do it, but each individual trial is not as robust as AVA. So there's some other context here. AIB probably can turn on REM, but it's also, you know, projecting to all these other neurons, which might be inhibiting this neuron. And so the challenge is to somehow isolate these relationships by removing the activity of these neurons, which are competing for, providing some competing input. And so one approach I've been using recently with the worm is the following. So here's a diagram of where the cell bodies are located in the head of the worm. The neurons I've been talking about are highlighted in color here. And what I've been expressing recently is this construct here. So that's I'm using a paneuronal promoter driving GCAMP and histamine gated chloride channel here, which is an inverted M cherry. So this is floxed, so that without CRE, all the neurons have GCAMP, all the neurons have the histamine gated chloride channel. However, if I express CRE in a specific neuron, so it's AWC, it flips this. So now all the neurons have GCAMP, almost all of them have the histamine gated chloride channel, except AWC. AWC is the only one without the histamine gated chloride channel. So now when I add histamine, all the neurons are hyperpolarized except AWC. So I've done a few test runs with this, and I find that in this situation, AVA has a spontaneous activity. But in this situation, AVA is silenced, but AWC is not hyperpolarized. It can give odor pulses, despite the fact the entire network has been shut off except this one neuron, and it can still respond. And so the idea is to try to do this with pairs of neurons and use a crimson as well to understand the transfer function between neurons. And also, hopefully, express, create in a population of neurons and try to understand what's the minimal circuit necessary to produce this fluctuating state. Because that will dramatically simplify the problem down to just a few key neurons so we can understand how it's generated in the first place. So these are all time dynamics on the calling time scale. However, what's not really focused on these global dynamic studies is the time scale of head motion. So the head moves on a faster time scale than the body. And there's a different set of motor neurons that control it. So this is the example of the crawling motion. They're all crawling around. And this undulatory motion provides thrust. And it's being steered by the head here, which you might be able to see is kind of moving at a slightly faster frequency. And interesting about the head is that if you split this up, the body has a fairly limited behavior, as you saw earlier. It either sort of has forward wave front or a reversal wave front. And part of that limitation is due to the fact that the muscles in the body are oriented either ventrally or dorsally. So the body can really only move along this axis. But the head actually has the muscles distributed more laterally, so the head is capable of far more finer motion in different dimensions. And so when I first joined the lab, my primary work focused on understanding the dynamics of head motion. So I put the worms in these traps and then monitored how the head behaved while they were just kind of sniffing around their environment, and then used some basic tracking algorithms to just track the motion of the head so I could track the nose and sort of like the neck of the worm. And so you can see there's different time scales here. There's the time scale of the neck. The neck is kind of what drives the time scale that drives the worm. And the time scale of the nose, which is on a faster time scale, that seems to be doing the sniffing behavior. When I first did this, I thought, oh, well, there seems to be some characters for frequency here. Perhaps there's some sort of central pattern generator. But after doing lots of experiments, I realized, actually, no, that's not the case. The head motion is actually quite stochastic. And in fact, we can just bend this into different ventral and dorsal states. And the statistics of this is very Poisson. And so just like the crawling behavior, which samples forward and reversal states in a very stochastic way, the head is also doing it on a faster time scale. And what I didn't mention earlier is that with these chemotaxis assays, they perform this bias random walk because the gradient is so shallow. However, if the gradient is steeper, they can bias the motion of their head and do a bias forward run. So in shallow gradients, they do this bias random walk. But as the gradient gets steeper, now when they're doing their head sweeping motion, now they can sense changes in the concentration, so now they can bias their head motion. Or at least that's the idea. So to address this, I've done some experiments where I put the worm in this trap, but provided odor on either one side or the other. And because of laminar flow, this is a very constant boundary. And on the y-axis here is time, and on x-axis here is the angle of the head. And there's a heat map of probability. So if you take several worms, on average, you know, their head motion gets kind of averaged out to the middle, but then when odor is present, the probability of the head motion is biased to the dorsal side or biased to the ventral side based on where the odor. So now we can try to understand, just like the previous assay, there's the substrate of the variability can be modified by sensory input, but this is a different network happening on a different time scale, which is also important for sensing its environment. And as I mentioned earlier, we know the position and location of all the neurons. We actually have that information for every single cell in the body. So we have that information for the muscles themselves. So the muscles are oriented along these sort of four sections here. These are the individual muscles in diagram form, obviously. And we can look at the network of motor neurons that project to these muscle cells. And with something, so this is color-coded based on number of synapses. So it's a very sparse the number of synapses that these motor neurons project to these muscle cells is quite sparse. It's just one or two. You might notice it's kind of wonky, right? I mean, these muscle cells receive synapses from several motor neurons. That's different than us, right? Our muscle cells receive synapses from one motor neuron, you know, after pruning and everything. But these worms seem to have muscle cells that receive information from several motor neurons. So isn't it entirely obvious why or what's going on here? In fact, this is a very understudied part of the worm's neuroanatomy. What exactly is going on here? Why does it have so many head motor neurons that all seem to be doing redundant behaviors? In previous ablation studies, it's been shown that these neurons here tend to be more important than the others. And another interesting observation is that these specific class of neurons here have very bistable responses to current ramps. So many of the neurons in the worm have graded potentials, but a few neurons, such as these, have step potentials. So this is kind of interesting because this behavior seems to be switching back and forth between two different states, and perhaps it's being driven by the dynamics of these neurons as they compete for dorsal or ventral motion. So I'd like to adjust this by doing calcium imaging as I've done before, but in the head. All right. And so the last thing I want to talk about isn't so much a behavior as it is a decision. So the worm goes through these four larval stages as it's developing. And during the first sort of 12 to 20 hours of life, it has to make a decision about how good the environment is, because that's going to be a prediction of how good the environment will be in the future. If it predicts that the environment is going to be favorable, it'll continue developing into an adult. If it thinks that the environment will be unfavorable, it'll develop into this dour stage, which is very robust. It doesn't even have a mouth. It's just like this sealed tube. And it can sustain like osmotic pressure and temperature and all sorts of things. And if the environment improves, it'll go back to becoming an adult. Now, this is an important decision because if it makes the wrong decision, if it decides the environment is fine and it's not, it's going to die. If it makes the wrong decision and says, oh, the environment is bad, and the environment is good, it'll be stuck in this dour state, and all these other guys will be taking advantage of the environment. Now, the signaling and the properties of this decision, there's been a lot of research, and it's a long time scale decision that's based on endocrine signaling, a lot of like insulins and TGF-beta signaling from different sets of sensory neurons and non-neurons in the body, which makes this decision. And the two primary sources of input about the conditions of the environment are food and pheromone. So the worms are constantly producing all these pheromones. On average, if there's a lot of pheromone, that means there's a lot of worms there, so there might not be very much food in the future, so I should become a dour. So if there's a lot of pheromone, low food, become a dour. If there's a lot of food, low pheromone, continue developing. And a lot of these assays looking into this behavior provide constant levels of food and constant levels of pheromone. But in reality, in the real world, on this time scale of hours, the environment must be fluctuating out in the soils of rotting fruit and everything that these worms live in. And recently, in a paper by Leon Avery, he pointed this out and he said, well, hold on a second. If the worms were smart, they would also monitor not only the average level of the quality, but the uncertainty of the environment. So that if the environment seems to be fairly good, on average, environmental quality is good, but your measurement of it is uncertain, you should hedge your bets and become a dour instead, because you're not entirely certain if that measurement is correct. However, producing controlled experiments where you control the food and pheromone are fairly difficult. However, in recent experiments by Alex Gottschalk, he used this very sensitive channel rhodopsin, C128S, which you can optically activate with very, very low levels of light, which means you can expose the animals to, instead of exposing the animals to really high intensity light for hours, you can expose them to a very low level for several hours and activate this neuron. And in his experiments, he activated ASJ and influenced the dour decision. So the worms were tricked into thinking that there's a lot of pheromone there, even though there wasn't. But in his assay, he only used a very low level of, a very constant low level of light. So it'd be very straightforward to just change this and do pulses where the average amount is the same, but there's a lot of variance here. And then ask, does the variance of the decision match the variance of the environment? Does variance matter at all? Or is the worm just monitoring the mean input into its system? And since these worms are so small, you can do these 96 well plates. The L1s are only about 250 microns long. And you can combine this with orthogonal level by having increasing levels of food to see how this integrates with this variability here. So you can look at variability. You can also look at the integration time. So all these assays are typically done by just having constant level throughout the whole lifetime. But you can imagine not having light off here, but only having light on during the most right before the dour decision. And ask how long of a history does the worm have with regard to the quality of the environment in the past? All right, so I hope what I've shown is that the advantage of the worm is that we have explicit knowledge over the structure of the network or the structure of lots of signaling in the worm. But you can't necessarily predict the behavior of the worm just based on structure alone. You need to know that what the dynamics are and the texture of the network to predict that behavior. And that's those are issues I would like to address. And in the last minute, I would like to address one other thing I'm interested in. I just started doing the lab. And it's also an ethological question. So the strength of the worm is it's very simple. It's a very simple neural network and simple behavior. And in some ways, it's kind of a drawback because the worms aren't reciting the works of Shakespeare or doing anything terribly complicated. They're just crawling around doing their thing. Well, complicated organisms are more interesting But their brains are more complicated as well. So ideally what you would like is a complex behavior with a simple brain. And I think an interesting organism to look into is the orb-weaving spider. So it produces this very elegant structure that's genetically encoded, and it produces this structure in complete darkness. So it requires path integration. It crawls down in the darkness, finds two vertical things that are the correct distance, and then produces this orb. And it performed error correction during the construction. So if while it's making these main lines, if you go and remove one, it'll come here, it'll notice that there's a local perturbation, realizes it has to replace this line, it'll go over here and replace it, so it knows where to go in space. And it can do local corrections as well. And one other insight into this path integration is that orb-weaving spiders, compared to other spiders, have very large central bodies. The central bodies are physiologically analogous to the central complex in insects. And recently, we showed the central complex is also a part in the insect which monitors the orientation of the fly in space. And so it was speculated 60 years ago that perhaps the central body in the spider also performs this role. And we see this role happening in insects. Now, the basic features of this behavior have been worked out over decades. And these are traces done by Samu Shaki in Basel, Switzerland. And all species of orb-weaving spiders basically produce the same behavior. They create a protoweb, which you can kind of see in red. It's just kind of this mess. And they create these radii in yellow, an axillary spiral in blue, a sticky spiral, auxiliary spiral white, sticky spiral in blue, and they eat the hub and they wait. So they all follow sort of the same general paradigm. But there are slight differences between individuals and between species. And this is also a thing that can be pharmacologically perturbed. So these classic studies done by Peter Witt in the 40s, where he gave the spiders all these different drugs and produced all these different structures. And there's a slight fictional account of this on YouTube, and I highly recommend it. It's quite entertaining. But I think one of the most striking features is that when he gave this spiders low levels of LSD, they actually made an improved web. So LSD improved their behavior, which is really striking. So all these experiments, the previous experiments, all of the analysis is done on the web, on the structure of the web. But the structure of the web, it reflects a behavioral structure, which no one really looks into. And so what I would like to do is to track the legs in 3D and objectively define features that are statistically definable features, and then quantify these features in time for individuals and across individuals, and then perturb them to understand which behavioral features were changed to produce this the structural feature change. Because you can imagine that a more structured web here could be due to a more structured behavior or more error correction, right? Because these spiders perform error correction. Am I pressing something? I don't know. Anyway, that was basically. Yeah. But I don't know what happened there. But anyway, what I've been doing is I have movies from that guy in Basel of spiders making webs. And it's just a two-dimensional movie. But when you watch the movie, you can see the spider, the spider isn't just a dot in space. It's doing all these things. It's testing the web. It's trying to figure out where it is. So basically, I'm taking these movies, and I'm using some algorithms used for Drosophila by Josh Shavitz's lab in Princeton to extract the most informative pixels from these movies to define behavioral epochs as the spiders producing the web. And so I want to, so I'm working on that to improve it, and then take that algorithm and then apply it to several of Samuel's movies and try to see what behavioral features change that produce the different structural features. And thank you all for inviting me. And Corey and several people in the lab. Oh yeah, so just quickly, so these are the videos I have. So this is making the auxiliary spiral here, sort of crawling around. When you're picking the auxiliary spiral, it just crawls around, and then pretty soon.
Is this in the dark?
This is in the dark, yeah. So this is under low light his experiments were under low light conditions. This is actually a VHS movie that he put in on DVD for me. And now it's doing the sticky spiral. So now it's sampling lots of other behaviors here as it moves along the radii. It also does a lot of high frequency sampling to try to understand what the auxiliary spiral is. And so when I am taking this approach by Gordon Berman, which is a soft law, where he basically has a similar experiment, but he's looking at flies, and he basically decomposes the pixel, most informant pixels down to these eigenmodes, pulls up the structural features, embeds this into lower dimensional space using stochastic neighbor embedding, and then he can sort of cluster these into different behavioral epochs and then say, okay, well, the flies moving around, it's sampling these different behavioral epochs. So I haven't gotten this far with the analysis yet, but just with the coarse grain approach, if you just cluster just the most informative eigenmodes down to just four clusters, just that analysis alone pulls out the auxiliary spiral and the sticky spiral. So it's performing the auxiliary spiral, it's just performing this sort of like constant crawling behavior. Once it gets to the sticky spiral mode, it does a lot more extension of the middle two legs. It's trying to sample, it wants to make sure it spaces its sticky spiral correctly. So it does lots of sampling to make sure it's doing it correctly. And it does lots of traveling along the radii. So it samples these three states repeatedly as it does the sticky spiral. It takes a lot longer. This is like the auxiliary spiral is done in 6 minutes. The rest of it takes about half an hour. At the very end, it does a radial maneuver up to the middle and then has a stereotyped posture here. And it has a stereotyped posture because it senses prey by the vibrations in the web. And so it's trying to sample as much of it as possible. So I'd like to thank Corey. She's really awesome. For many reasons. Derek Albrecht, who developed the microfluidic assays along with Johannes, Levine Pokler for developing the histamine Corey channel, Steve Sagi with the help of the Crimson experiments, the people at Genelia. So I worked very closely with them to try to find the best tools for worms, so the GCAMP, RCAMP, glutamate sensors. It's been a very fruitful collaboration. Bill Eberhard and Samuel for lots of help with spider biology and funding. Thanks.
Maybe I have time for a few quick questions.
Yeah, so just want to repeat the same question. So if you just sense the absolute order, that's just the baseline. What you want to sense is the gradient. Right? That's different.
Right, so
you have to have a certain window into which you integrate.
Right. So the AWC neuron isn't a very good integrator. So we've done some experiments, and it habituates, but doesn't integrate. It doesn't change, since the change is in order so much as just the constant level. However, there's another neuron, AWA, which can also sense isoamyl alcohol, but at higher concentrations. And that one can sense the changes very well. And that sensory neuron seems to be more important for this biased crawling I talked about earlier. So that neuron seems to be more tuned to biasing the head motion, probably because it is sensing higher concentrations. So once it gets closer, now it can start sensing those differences. And AWC seems to be more important for these like low-level gradients, where you're just kind of shifting the baseline level of AWC. It has a slow habituation time as well. But you're right. So the differentiation appears to happen more. With other neurons at higher concentrations.
And these network states, are these attractors, like the stable states in the phase diagram, or
right.
What do you mean by the state?
I think that the general idea is that these neurons probably are contributing to some sort of, some strange attractor, but they're fluctuating between these two states. But we have no idea how that's being generated. I mean, the dwell times seem to follow Poisson statistics. So the null hypothesis would be that it isn't a strange attractor, that it's just dependent on some sort of chemical signaling that's reaching some threshold. But it would be interesting if it was a strange attractor. And which is why I would like to isolate portions of this to see how deterministic it is. If deterministic relationships between neurons predict more unpredictable deterministic structure, if you allow more elements to be present. I mean, minimally, you'd only need like three nonlinear variables to produce an attractor. I think things you can pursue.
Wait, did you want to say?
Yeah, I have a question. So you're showing the activities in GCAM, mm-hmm. but which works pretty well if you're looking at a neuron that you're looking for activation. But I'm wondering how are you going to go about looking at the relevant activities of neurons where there might be inhibitory neurons where rises in calcium may not be the relevant signal. It could be changes in cycle AMP, cycle
right.
GMP. And
so we actually tested several GCAMs with different off rates with a few of these neurons. And you can take the, the fluorescence decay here, and you can deconvolve this with the known decay of the GCAMP sensor. So you have some sort of kernel here. You can deconvolve it and get out the true decay. What we find is that you can take these different GCAMPs with these different kernels, and we have these different fluorescence data. And you basically, when you deconvolve them, you get the same decay, which is an indication that there's this underlying decay in the neurons that we're sensing through the sensor. And the different sensors produce different output, but if you deconvolve the known kinetics of that GCAMP with the output, you get the same decay. So there's an indication that, the dynamics of the neurons are fairly slow. So the kinetics of the GCAMP don't seem to be a limiting factor for that. That
makes sense. Okay. Sorry to cut off the discussion, but the faculty can close. Thanks a lot.